Welcome, listeners, to The Cozy Corner with Alexia Gordon, the podcast dedicated to the lighter side of crime fiction. I'm Alexia Gordon, author and host. On each episode, I interview an author writing cozy, traditional, or historical mysteries. You won't find mysteries with explicit sex or violence. You will find mysteries with high-quality writing, intriguing plots, and engaging characters. Thanks for listening. Welcome, listeners, to another episode of The Cozy Corner with Alexia Gordon. I'm Alexia Gordon, your host. Katrina McPherson returns to the corner today to chat about her new historical mystery, In Place of Fear. Welcome back, Katrina.
Thank you very much for having me back.
Now, you have a series of historical mysteries, the Dandy Gilver series, but In Place of Fear is different. So would you please tell us about your newest book?
Yes, certainly. Yeah, it is different. I finally made it. So the 15 Dandy Gilver novels are about an aristocratic sleuth. So it's a world of butlers and fabulous clothes. And I love historical novels, but my background is not that. I'm a working class kid. So what I've finally managed with this historical novel is to marry those two things together, the history and... But she's a tenement kid. The protagonist of this novel is someone who was born in a tenement. And I've lived in a tenement flat, not with my family, not with, you know, six other people. So it was slightly more comfortable. And it's set in Edinburgh, where I'm from. And it opens in 1948, which was so usefully inside my mother's living memory. So research, like naughty research problems, I could just phone up and say, oh, hey, Mum, can you remember... Blah, blah, blah. When I say it's set in the 1940s, it's set in 1948. It opens on July the 4th, 1948, which is not Independence Day in Edinburgh. What it is the Sunday before the Monday morning when the National Health Service started in Britain. Everything started in one day. A huge effort to get this enormous system of health and welfare up and running in one day. And my protagonist, Helen Crowther, is a tiny little cog in that huge machine.
So for those of us who aren't familiar with the National Health Service and its origins, would you tell us a little about it and how it got started?
Yes, it was. Well, the best way for American people to understand it is it's like Medicare, Medicaid and OSHA, except it's for, and the VA, except it's for all of them and everyone else. So it's just a completely universal, free point of access health service. So American friends, who we've got a friend who was struck with kidney stones when he was on holiday in London and got in an ambulance and went to the hospital and had his kidney stones removed and stayed for a couple of nights and then got a prescription and then got ushered out the door. And he just was waiting for that moment where someone was going to mention money. And there was no money mentioned. And it was for him, it was as weird as for me if I was to go into a supermarket and pick off the shelf everything that I fancied eating and then just walk out. It's that strange for someone who doesn't come from a country that's got that way. I mean, we do pay for it. We pay for it through an national insurance, but everybody just pays national insurance and it just disappears and it's gone. And it's really cheap. But why it started? So it started in 1948 because the War Office noticed when they started to conscript soldiers. Wow, can't say that. In 1939, that a lot of the, you know, not the officer class, darling, but a lot of the rank and file, or the kids that were going to be rank and file, were really unhealthy. Malnourished and, you know, poxy and, you know, teeth falling out their head and just not in good shape at all. And also some of the evacuees from the inner cities that were, you know, evacuated out of London and the other big cities, Birmingham and Manchester, to the country, you know, to terribly nice ladies in the country, were malnourished, you know, skinny, teeth falling out their head, filthy, lousy, you know, covered in fleas. And so it was a reckoning with the state of British Health. And I think, I mean, from my reading, from my research when I was working on the book, I think without the war effort, it couldn't have been done because there was this huge machine organised, you know, to get that going, to feed everyone and to produce everything that was needed and to organise everything. And so it was kind of the muscles to make something as big and bad as a war, even a just war, work, were there to make something as big and not bad as the National Health Service work. So it got up and it got going in 1948. But I've enjoyed talking a little bit about the teething problems. I mean, my protagonist, Helen Crowther, is not a doctor. She's not a nurse. You know, she's not a physiotherapist. She's not an optician. She's not any of these things. Leading question. I'll leave the question for you.
Well, and you mentioned teething pains. Granted, this is something I heard on, I think, an episode of BBC's Agatha Christie, but or it might have been Midsummer Murders. Wasn't there some controversy surrounding it? Not everyone thought the National Health Service was a wonderful idea.
Absolutely, yeah. Some of the it was controversial, as you can imagine. It was controversial at the time. Some people, I mean, so there are always going to be some people who hate the idea of other people getting something they might not deserve, you know, like, or some people getting something that they've got. It sort of, what do you call it, positional good. If you've got something that's got exclusivity, I can't help thinking about the baby blankets in Tiffany's. It's like 3 square feet of plastic fleece, and it's $450. And the only value in that damn thing is that you've got it and everyone else doesn't, you know. So there's always some of that because, you know, not everyone's nice. And also, people didn't think it would work. Doctors thought that they would be, you know, standing on the corner with a cup out because they weren't going to be, they thought they'd have to, they thought they'd be overworked. So yeah, it was, there were. And also, people didn't like the idea that their doctor, posh people, didn't like the idea that their doctor was going to go from their bedside to some, you know, box bed in a tenement, and then, or no, that would be fine. It would be the other way that would be a problem. So there was a lot of concern about it, and concern that people would abuse the system. Oh, but in fact, even when I was born in 1965, it was well up and running by then, and so my sort of clear memories maybe start about 1970. But then, and even now, there's a great sense of, oh, you don't want to bother the doctor. Are you sure you need to go? Because you don't want to bother the doctor. People were so aware that they were being given something that certainly everyone I knew, it was you really, I mean, to the point of you made it more difficult for the doctor because by the time you rocked up there, you were in such a state that it was hard to fix. It was hard to fix what you needed done. But yes, it did have teething pains, but I'm looking at it in this book. I'm looking at it from the point of view of there's a couple of doctors who work in a practice in a very depressed, well, not depressed, I mean there was full employment, but the employment was in a brewery and a slaughterhouse and a dairy and a, you know, a distillery and things like that. So it was a very blue collar neighborhood, and I suppose in a place like that, it was a solid good. It was, you know, and I'm not scared of tugging the heartstrings. I've got the first morning, Miss, oh heck, what's she called? Mrs. Sutty, I think, who has an adult son who doesn't have the use of his legs and has been dragging him around in a little homemade cart on old pram wheels. And she's really burly from pushing and dragging this 20-year-old man around, brings him to the surgery on the first day. To be measured for calipers and to get a little chit to take to some office to get a wheelchair. And they take such pity on him that they give him the show model wheelchair. They give him the one that they've got, and then they've got, we'll order another one. So it's just nice little things like that. Like people getting spectacles who didn't have spec who weren't able to see and couldn't afford glasses, and suddenly they've got glasses. So yes. But there's a lot of you know, kind of unwashedness, a few lice around as well. Everybody likes that. That's why I think that's why everyone likes a Dyson, because you can see the filth that's come off your carpet. You know, everybody likes to look at that kind of thing to a certain extent. But so my protagonist, since you didn't ask, I led you up to, with she's not a nurse and she's not a doctor and she's not this, and then you didn't ask, say, Katrina, what is she? So I'll just tell you if you want me to.
You can.
Yeah.
I have learned to just kind of follow your flow.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So what she is, so what I thought was an interesting shift from the medicine, like private medicine, health for people who could afford it, to National Health Service, which was this book's had so many working titles, and one of them was From the Cradle, because the first slogan of the National Health Service was From the Cradle to the Grave, that we will take care of you from the cradle to the grave. It's all under one. But In Place of Fear, which is the title of the book, was the name of the manifesto of the welfare state. That sounds so much like there should be the, Soviet marching band in the background. But it was written by the Prime Minister, and it was it, the this little book is called In Place of Fear, and it was about it was a manifesto for taking care of people. I don't think it should be that controversial. And I couldn't believe no one else had used this title for a novel, because it's a great title for a novel. So that's my title, In Place of Fear. And one of the interesting changes was that there was a system of lady, and they were volunteer almoners, I don't know how you say it, whose job it was to do a kind of triage. So when someone landed all kind of squashed and upset in the hospital, these ladies would work out whether they were destitute and they had to go to the poorhouse and be looked after by the poor laws, or whether they were absolutely fine and perfectly able to pay for a doctor, in which case they got shunted out a different door, or whether they could be looked after by this patchwork of charities and welfare societies and philanthropists and things. So this was a big, this almonry was a big bit of what went on with health in the 30s and 40s, and their job just disappeared overnight. But what happened almost instantly was they became professional welfare officers for the National Health Service. So they were the precursors of what we'd call medical social workers now. They don't have medical training. They're just there to look at someone, and instead of working out, well, where is this, how are we going to pay for what this person needs, they're now looking at someone saying, well, what does this person need, and how can I fill in all these, God, can you imagine the paperwork with all the carbons and flimsies and going off to different offices? Because it's a huge government machine. I'm sure that some of the forms were just would make springs pop out of your head. So almost instantly there was this new class of professional, mostly women, who were doing this brand new job that no one quite understood, except you were kind of asking very nosy questions and interfering, and were to some extent the gatekeeper of a lot of this great new stuff. And that's what my protagonist is. She is a bright working class kid who was spotted at the Girl Guides by Mrs. Sinclair, a lady almoner with a fox fur and a feather in her hat and all the rest of it, and taken under her wing as a protege. And now she has become an upstart who everyone disapproves of, because instead of staying under Mrs. Sinclair's wing and waiting to see what's going to happen, she's taken a job. So she's shocked her mentor, scandalized her parents because she's working in a doctor's surgery with two men, unmarried men, doctors, and really discombobulated her husband, who everyone expects should be taking care of her. She shouldn't be. And he's a road cleaner, he's a street sweeper. So she's vaulted like up a class or half a class from him. So she's this young woman who's done this quite daring, for her, very daring thing, and everybody's annoyed with her, at least annoyed, if not horrified by her. But she's determined that she's going to do this. She's terrified but determined that she's going to do this thing.
And one thing I was going to ask about your protagonist, Helen, as you have mentioned, she is working class, which is a very different social class than Dandy Gilver, the protagonist of your other historical series. So how does being working class instead of an aristocrat kind of influence Helen's approach to crime solving?
Oh, yeah, because that's the thing. This is a crime novel. So all that, all that's going on, my city, the family, the mentor, the protege, the NHS, she stumbles over a corpse in chapter one, obviously. So there is that. She's got less freedom because she's got to go to work. She's got to present herself for work at 9 o'clock every morning and stay there till 5 o'clock in the afternoon. However, she works. It's just her. She's got her own little office, and she works for these two doctors who are not concerned with how she's. As long as she does her work, they're not looking over her shoulder all the time. She doesn't have any spare money, so but that's okay because it's fictional, and I just made it that everything happens in the city and there are buses. And she also, when she's finished work, she needs to go home. She can't gad about the way that Dandy Gilbert did. She's not able to do that, but she's got that other kind of freedom in that she is paid to be in about everyone's business, and she can tramp about the city. And she talks herself into the mortuary in Edinburgh. She manages to get into the mortuary to look at this, to have a second look at this corpse, which I don't think Dandy Gilver would have been able to do. She might have been able to do it just with the sheer cut of her vowels, just look down her nose and intimidate everyone until she gets what she wants. But by the late 40s, and I would say thankfully, that's beginning to break down. That, do you know who I am? So just hop to it, young lad. It's beginning to not work so much anymore. So yes, she has to be more resourceful of herself because she doesn't have all the resources that my lady detective had. It was great fun to write.
And you sort of touched on this as well. This is 1948. Well, both of your historical series are after World Wars, but this one is after the second one. So what were things kind of like for folks after that war? I mean, it's still close enough that I imagine things like rationing and things like
Oh
that were still going on.
yeah, the rationing is still going on, so the ration books are a big thing, and I had to keep reminding myself that she can't just go out and buy buns. She's got to have a ration book to go out and buy buns for the doctors or whatever. I think what the difference between writing a well-to-do character with domestic staff and all the rest of it in 1922, which is when Dandy started, and writing this working class character in 1948, so 3 years after the end of the Second World War, as against 4 years after the end of the First World War. Terribly badly designed scientific experiment because I've changed two variables, right? But I think that from my reading, I wasn't there. But from my reading of memoirs of the time and diaries of the time, not the newspaper, not propaganda, but people's lived experience, there was less, I don't want to say there was less trauma, but the difference between the experience of the Second World War and the trenches of the First World War was not nothing. And the knowledge that stopping Hitler made, and Mussolini made, the Second World War a just war for anyone who believes that there can be such a thing, whereas people knew at the end of the First World War that it was largely a glass bead game for the generals, and that this horrendous death toll, it was quite hard to work out why all those young men had lost their lives. And from reading people's memoirs in the 20s and people's memoirs in the 40s, that made a massive difference. Even given that, the bombing and the loss and the grief that went on, I think that might just be from the things I've read, but I think it made a big difference.
That's
Even though, I
interesting.
mean, sorry, go ahead.
That's interesting because I would have guessed that there would have been a difference, but maybe sort of the other way. I mean, I would assume that after the First World War was called the Great War because no one imagined it would happen again.
The war to end all wars. Yeah.
Whereas after World War II, they knew, okay, this is the second time that this has happened. But so I guess I would have thought that would have made people perhaps more cynical and pessimistic. And I guess I'm thinking that's kind of when like American noir and the tough guy detective rose.
Yeah.
But I hadn't thought of it from the aspect of maybe thinking of it as a more just war would counteract some of that pessimism. So have you noticed a big difference between the attitudes, and you touched on it, you know, of the experience of we've just come through this terrible war, but no one will ever do it again, versus we've now come through two terrible wars. There's, you know, all bets are off for the future. Or am I just making that up?
No, I don't think you are. That's certainly there as well. And it's useful to and that certainly is there as well, because there was the war to end all war, the Great War, never again. You know, there was going to be peace in our time. But then there was the Spanish flu. And then there was the Depression, you know, whereas after the Second World War, there wasn't a pandemic and there was a boom. I mean, the recovery after the end of rationing, which is not there in 1948, right enough, but there wasn't a depression after the Second World War. And there was that sense of, although as you're saying that, I'm thinking that I was listening to someone, listening or reading, I can't remember now but it was someone called Oliver Postgate, who was a cartoonist. But interesting to me because for lots of reasons, but one of them was that he was a conscientious objector in the Second World War, precisely because he thought, well, we did this 20 years ago and there was the Versailles Treaty that was so harsh on Germany that he blamed the terms of the Versailles Treaty for causing the rise of Hitler and causing the Second World War. And he thought, if we do this again, it's just going to happen again, and then there's going to be another one in 20 years' time. And that was, you know, that was precisely his reason for being a conscientious objector. So yes, that was certainly there as well. Yeah.
Now, how do you get into all these different, mindsets of the world you write about? Because you've got a contemporary humorous series, a historical series set in between two world wars, contemporary standalone suspense novels, and now a historical mystery set after World War II. And, you know, as we've been kind of discussing, people themselves, you know, from a physiological standpoint were the same, but their mindsets were very, very different in all of those different worlds. You can't just write the same character for each of those books. You have to craft something, you know, beyond just a different plot and just a different time. And even with it, you still have to, like, the research is different. Like, you know, you could talk to your mom about 1948. You've got to read memoirs about the First World War. So how do you juggle so many different worlds to, you know, put them together into a book?
Well, you've hit the nail on the head there exactly with that one word. It's different worlds. It's not different people. It's maybe, you know, the character is not a character, a protagonist is not fundamentally different, but she, and it is always she, although I've got three voice characters in this book I'm finishing right now, and two of them are men. I've done it. but funnily enough, the woman is in first person and the two men are in third. So I still can't quite do that. But the protagonist is the protagonist is the protagonist, you know, shy or extrovert, you know, optimistic or gloomy, but what molds her are the constraints of the time. So I'm always thinking about what would people think, what would she be able to do, what would be a stretch, what would be easy. And I think that's largely true, although I was just thinking about Jane Austen's heroines this morning, because I was listening to an online book club where someone had chosen Persuasion, where Anne Elliot says of Lady Russell, I think I was right to be persuaded not to marry Captain Wentworth, even though her advice to me not to do it was wrong. And that's a huge leap from us as modern women to back to the mindset to say, even if what you're telling me to do is wrong, I am right to obey you because you're older than me and you're in a position of, you know, she's like a proxy mother to me. So I was thinking about that just today, just that sort of some, you know, you can't just take a 21st century, feminist shaded, feminist inflected, let's say, woman and plop her down in the 20s, or in the 40s, or in, as some people do, the 1300s. It just really annoys me when people do that. Oh yes, my character's a nun, but she's a feisty agnostic nun. That's just not right to me. So there are differences, but I'm not sure if maybe I think maybe my heroines are modern enough. When you look at the television adaptations of Jane Austen, there's never much of the devoutness of Jane, where she was seriously and committedly devout and serious-minded about religion, and that always just goes because it's not for modern sensibilities. So it is a real issue, but I think maybe I'm just old enough. Maybe I'm just old enough to think I can remember when, like, the old ladies when I was a girl were the forgotten generation. They were the women, not the forgotten generation, like the, no, that's not what you call them. What do you call
What
them?
they call
The,
surplus women?
oh God, yes, that's exactly, yes, them, the ones whose sweethearts are died. They were there, and I was quite a, I mean, I think you'd probably call it an old soul. I always liked hanging out with old people, getting a nice cup of tea and a soft, slightly strange biscuit and listening to the stories. And so they were still there. They were the women that ran everything when I was a child. And certainly, 1948, because of my reading and because of my granny and elderly aunts and things, just doesn't feel like that long ago. And the things, I know what things I did that made them gasp because they wouldn't have done it. So it doesn't feel too, and until I get lots of letters saying, "You, well, you got that wrong." I think the recent past is much more difficult to research because there aren't, it hasn't reached prominence enough for people to write about it a lot. I always remember the first, one of the hardest things I ever had to research was to find out, and forgive me if I've said this before, but to find out whether someone could buy ready-made fondant icing in the 80s. I just could not find out. I couldn't find where you would even find that out. Whether it would be crazy to make someone be, mashing up marshmallows and water and sugar, or whether it would be anachronistic to have someone buy a tub of fondant icing. I didn't know. And that's much harder than to find out anything about rationing or the birth of the health service or, the rents in the tenements in the 40s.
Yeah, I guess the recent history is not, I don't know, exotic enough to people, I
Yeah,
guess, to
exactly.
be
Yeah, I think you're
researching
right. Yeah.
it.
Yeah, and people don't see the point of, well, if you can remember it, like people not writing people's names on the backs of photographs, which is, anytime someone's had to deal with a box of photographs taken by someone who's no longer there, wants to get out the Ouija board and say, "Why didn't you write down who these people were?" No, and I'm guilty as charged. I haven't done it either, so maybe I'll do it. Yeah.
Oh, and I do want to take a minute to give credit for knowing the term surplus woman. It's because I listened to Caroline Crampton's podcast. She done it. I didn't just happen to know that, but she did an episode on the surplus
Well,
women.
that
So.
is the rather awful phrase for the women whose sweethearts and potential sweethearts had died in the First World War. It never occurred to me when I was a child to wonder why there were so many old ladies and hardly any old men, like so many in the village where I was born. But that was why.
Now, what did you enjoy the most about writing In Place of Fear? You put a lot of effort into recreating the post-World War II environment. I mean, what was the most fun about doing that?
Oh, the houses. I love houses. So the describing the tenement flat where Helen lives with her mother and her father, and so this is a flat with one bedroom, her mother, her father, and her husband and her little sister. But there are alcove box beds in the kitchen, which is a big room, and in the big room, as they called it, the posh room. So I love describing that, and then describing where she moves to, because she moves to a very particular kind of Edinburgh workers' housing called the Colonies, which are still there, and they're very posh now. They're very desirable, especially the ones in nice neighbourhoods. But they were designed for kind of weavers and tradespeople, carpenters, mill workers in the Victorian times, as healthful housing, because each house had its own door and had a little patch of garden and a bathroom inside, which was amazing. And then she lucks into, then this is hands down my favourite thing that I wrote, she lucks into the discarded old furniture and household goods that are in the attic of this Georgian house where the two doctors have their surgery. So one of the doctors, it was his father's surgery before him, and they used to live in the house, and he's just bundled up all the old stuff and put it in the attic. And when Helen and Sandy, her husband, need quickly to furnish this little kind of upstairs cottage that they've got, they just send it all round in tea chests and carpets rolled up and bales of curtains and things. And to them, it's they've cleared the attics. But to Helen, who on the first night goes to get some straw from the co-op stables and some ticking to make something soft enough to lie on the floor, and has porridge made with water and cold water out of the tap for breakfast in the morning. So for her, as it would be for me, because I like going dumpster diving, as it would be for me, it's just Aladdin's cave. It's just treasure, taking the tops off these tea chests to see what's inside. These crazy lined and interlined damask curtains that are 12 feet tall, that she's got to cut them down for every room. So they're even in the kitchen, these very, you know, frou-frou drawing room curtains. And, you know, she's maybe got a set of 12 matching brandy glasses. She doesn't need 12 brandy glasses, but they're in the tea chest, so now she's got them. That was just, oh man, I loved that. I just loved that, because I would be exactly the same if it was me. And there were none of it, would I wouldn't give any of it back. I would find a use for absolutely everything.
Actually, I'm sitting here at a table that came from my grandmother's house that I think she bought from the lady she used to work for probably back in 1930. So I appreciate things like that as well.
Yeah, you get it. If someone said, oh, here's some stuff that's sort of from the turn of the 19th to 20th century, I don't need it anymore. I'll just send it down to your house and you can rootle through it and see what you can find. That was great fun. That and the filth. The filth was good fun to write as well.
Houses and filth.
Yeah. Like, what would happen if someone had just given up? What would happen in a house? What would it look like? What would under the sink look like if someone had just given up? That was fun to write.
And since there's the... just like many Americans are not familiar with the National Health Service, I've also noticed that there are housing terms that, you know, our view of what they are is not necessarily what the British view of what they are. So tenement, that sounds a bit more upscale than what I'm picturing. I'm picturing, you know, the New York City, Chicago things where,
that's
like,
right.
You know,
yeah.
98 people are crammed into a place
pretty
designed
much.
For 12.
Yeah.
So is it, this is
well,
the same?
Yeah, I mean, tenement housing, it would be like a tall, gaunt building all joined together in a big row. So, and each door that goes in, maybe the staircase goes up the middle, up four flights, and there's two or three flats, apartments off each landing. So yeah, same thing. In Edinburgh, though, there were tenements that were everything from what's called a single end. So that's just one room where it's bedroom, living room, kitchen. There are no bathrooms inside any of these. To, you know, a room and kitchen, which is what, no, or and then there's two room and kitchen, which is what I was going to say Lexi, which is what Helen lives in with her family. And that's what I lived in. My first flat was a two room and kitchen. But there's only two of us living in it. And But they get very grand. I mean, you get tenement flats in Edinburgh that have got servants' quarters in them. So the people live in with huge bay windows and 12-foot ceilings and fancy moulding and, you know, drawing rooms and dining rooms, and then there's smaller rooms at the back where the maid lives. So they really span the working class, poor working class, all the way up to kind of doctor, lawyer, upper middle class, span the tenements.
Okay, so
And
it's a
now they're all fine. So they were all made of stone. Nothing was built of brick. So they didn't ever fall. Well, they got bombed, but the ones that didn't get bombed, they didn't fall down. So they'd never got razed. They mostly got upgraded, and now they're really nice houses. You know, they're nice places to live
Okay, so
in
tenement's more of
Edinburgh.
the architectural style rather than
Yes.
the economic class,
Yeah.
because I don't think here tenement is never applied to a place where a doctor or lawyer would be living.
No, I don't. So you'd say, you know, it's just their apartments that are perfectly nice, and some of them are dazzlingly nice, you know. But it is a big difference, because I remember that sitcom Roseanne.
Yes.
I remember watching that sitcom and not understanding the humor, because to me they looked rich, because their house wasn't joined on to anybody else's house and they had two cars. So
Oh,
to
wow.
me they were rich, because the only people that had a house that didn't have neighbors through the wall were rich people. And two cars, you're rich. So a lot of it, I thought, I don't know what it is there. I can't get what they're referring to, because they were speaking in coded ways about their, you know, financial distress. Didn't look financially distressed to me. Although some of their decor choices were questionable. So yeah, it's a big difference.
So one thing readers will be able to do when they read In Place of Fear is sort of get a cross-cultural lesson as well as a history lesson.
Yes, certainly the as soon as Helen, when she's deciding whether she wants to listen, whether she wants to move into this flat, this little house, upstairs cottage. So what it was is there's a long block of houses, gable end on to the street, and the downstairs houses, the door is on one side of this long block, and the upstairs houses is an exterior staircase, and their front door is to the other side. So there's a great deal of privacy, except that your windows look out onto the other person's garden. And to me, it's just an interesting setup, because you're so close, but you don't run into each other ever. You never meet each other, but you're very close. But when she's trying to decide whether she's going to accept this gift horse, there's a bathroom, and she thinks, you know, this is going to change my life. This is unbelievable. There's no more looking out the window to see whether any of the other neighbours are waiting outside the only toilet down there in the middle of the back green, and then rushing down there and hoping to get in there, and then going to the baths in Caledonian Road on a Friday night. So not only me, but my mum will be round here, my sister will be round here, the whole family, that's it. We're never going to have a public bath again. And that was a big moment for her. I've done something similar. I've been in America for 12 years, and now I think I'll never be able to share a bathroom. It used to be so normal. Family of six, one bathroom, dead normal. Flat share, four roommates, one bathroom, dead normal. Now I'm thinking I'm spoiled by living in America with my own bathroom. It just seems a bit gross. I apologized to a friend who came from home, because their bathroom that was just for them was across the hall from the bedroom. Ooh, the squalor. And I said, oh, I'm sorry, it's across the way. And they looked at me as if to say, who are you? What's happened? But I do love the American generosity with bathrooms. Thank you.
Readers can thank you by buying a copy of your book. So where can they buy a
Oh,
copy of
yes.
In Place of Fear?
Yes, thank you very much. I hope they do. I had such fun writing it, poking around all the grubbiest corners of my beloved city.
And when is it available for folks to buy?
It is out on the 27th of June.
Okay.
It's out on Kindle right now,
Oh.
but the beautiful It feels like a sugared almond hardback is out on the 27th of June.
And it'll be available in wherever fine books are sold.
Yes,
Isn't that the saying?
I would think so. I would think so. Yes, thank you.
And what's next for you? Is there another Helen Crowther story on the way, or from one of your other series, or another standalone?
The next thing that comes out is going to be the modern California set comedy. Totally the biggest difference from the historicals, and it's coming out in the winter. It's called Scott in a Trap. Ooh, you have to say that afterwards. And then after that, there's this one that I'm just finishing off, which is a modern psychological suspense with the three protagonists set in the bleakest bit of the old lead hills with shut lead mines and flooded villages in Scotland. And I think it rains on every page, except sometimes it snows. So it's a real love letter to Scottish weather, that one. Yeah, it's still stuck with its working title at the moment, though. So I don't know what that title is. And as to which historical comes next, I still haven't decided. I think one of the things I need to do when I am just about to head over to Britain is have a long head scratching session with my agent and editor and say, right, what are we doing then? Is it Dandy? Is it Helen? Is it both? Which one comes first? What are we doing? How to decide? I don't know, but what a nice problem to have. Like who to visit again next?
Yes. Okay. Yeah. And where can readers connect with you to find out who won that battle, or and find out about your other books?
Yes, I've got a website. It's www.katrinamcpherson.com. I am at Katrina McP on Twitter, because my name's too long, and I'm Katrina McPherson author on Facebook, because I'm very happy I got in fast. I managed to get my name with no numbers because I got in nice and early on that. And I still don't use Instagram. Every time I talk to you, Alexia, I'm feeling guilty because I'm still not using Instagram.
You have an Instagram account, though, because I'm following you. I'm actually trying to find it now. Like I know you're here because I follow you.
That's how I managed to get my own name, because I just secure my real estate. But I don't use it
there
yet.
We go.
I don't use it yet. What is okay. my Instagram name? Is it? Did I get my name? Have I got numbers?
Katrina McPherson, the person. You also have Katrina and Lexi.
Oh, wow, two.
Yes,
how disorganized of me. And I don't use either of them. But no, Facebook, Katrina McPherson, and Twitter, Katrina McP.
Okay. Well, thank you, Katrina McP, Katrina McPherson, Katrina and Lexi, for coming back to the corner to chat with me again.
Thank you very much. It was wonderful. Thanks, Alexia.
And thank you, listeners, for tuning in to another episode of The Cozy Corner with Alexia Gordon. Today's guest was Katrina McPherson, author of In Place of Fear. I'm Alexia Gordon, your host. Until next time, goodbye.
Thank you for listening to The Cozy Corner with Alexia Gordon, part of the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. I'm Alexia Gordon, award-winning author and host of the show. Tune in next time for another chat with an author writing on the lighter side of crime. Until then, goodbye.